we've all walked by people singing or playing instruments with an open guitar case for money. Busking is such a normal part of city life that you can see it 1,000 times without stopping to think much about it. But when you do stop to think about it, questions quickly arise, like, can you make a living this way? Do you have to get permission to be on a certain street corner or at a certain bus stop? Is it even legal? Well, there's a big busking festival going on in Lawrence this coming weekend. People are coming in for it from all over the country. And you know how some places have lots of buskers and others not so much? The differences in local ordinances from one city to the next may have something to do with that. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to learn the nitty-gritty of busking law. My first guest is a local performer. Her name is Jazz. Her one-woman band is called Jazzy Jams, and she has had a run-in with security officers here in town in that kind of gray area where busking butts up against panhandling. More on that in a minute. Hi, Jazz.
Hello.
Describe what you do, what your act is, how it came about.
Well, I'm a singer-songwriter. I discovered my talent for singing when I was 4 years old. I believe it was God-given. And then I discovered my songwriting ability around age 12. And so I decided to go out busking one day.
How old were you by this point?
By that point, I was about 38, 39.
So you're a 38, 39-year-old woman getting ready to go out to the street corner. Did you have any thoughts about what are the rules about this, or you just headed out, you had a song to sing, you wanted to reach people?
Well, in driving by the plaza, I saw people out singing and playing the guitars and accepting tips. And so I thought that, you know, it was okay to do that. But I wanted to be on the safer side. So I went down to the BizCare office in downtown Kansas City. And I asked them, was there any special permit or any licensing that I would need to go out and do busking? And they told me no, that they did not have anything I could pay for that would be able to be shown to a security guard or officer or business owner nearby that would validate me being there. And so I just got my equipment together one sunny day and decided to go out and give it a try.
Where did you go?
I went to the plaza first, in the same spot that I had seen others performing in, and it happened to be empty that day. So I set up my equipment and began singing songs that everybody, you know, loves, like, you know, some Motown music and music from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so, you know, that was...
What did it feel like? Did it feel good to just go out there and see what would happen?
I was nervous. I didn't know what to expect. And as a woman going out there virtually alone at times, I didn't know if... anyone would object or do anything. So,
wait, can you explain that a little bit more?
I was on high alert.
Yeah,
you know, because I have some equipment that was kind of pricey for me to buy, and I didn't want anyone to walk by and take it and run off into the distance, and so, I thought about all these possibilities, the negative possibilities and the good possibilities.
What were the good possibilities?
The good possibilities was that people would smile, people would laugh, people would dance, people would sing along.
Did you have that experience?
I did.
I heard a woman who did kind of like the human statue thing.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a story from someone who had done that, talking about the eye contact she would make with people, just total strangers, while she was standing there kind of like frozen.
Uh-huh.
And just how magical it was to share a wordless kind of moment with a stranger like that.
Right. That has to be very intense. Yes. I had a lot of nice moments. I had a precious moment where a grandmother and her grandchildren happened to be strolling by, and the little girls were just amazed to see what I was doing there, just singing. And they talked to their grandmother, and their grandmother came up to me and asked, could I play a child's type song? And so I said, yes, I sing children's music as well. So she said, do you have Jesus Loves Me? And I said, yes, I do. So after I sang that song, I put on Jesus Loves Me, and I started to bend down and sing that to the little girls, looking in their eyes, and they were looking in mine. And it was a very touching moment to share that with a little girl, and she didn't want to leave my side after that.
So the joys of doing this, why street corners instead of, say, either a church choir or a club or music venue? Why was the street corner where you went?
Well, it was because I had reached out to some local clubs in the area that people had suggested that I check into, and they thought I would be a good fit in those clubs. And I didn't receive a warm welcome as a newcomer, not being recommended by anyone that they knew. They were kind of...
You were just trying to get your start.
Apprehensive about trusting me and getting to know me. So since I felt, you know, the hesitation there, I didn't proceed. I just looked for other options. And so when I ran out of options, I said, well, then I'm going to have to go out on the street and sing to the general public and see what their opinion of me is.
Just take out the middleman.
Right.
So you started learning about the rules and laws around busking by trying it. First, heading to an office, asking, you know, what do I need? And you hear, like, nothing. Mm-hmm. But then just... It sounds like once you actually got out there, you did butt up against some trouble and learned what you could and couldn't do by figuring out what kept people off your case.
Right. The first run-in, I think, was security coming over and asking me to turn the music down.
Is this on the plaza?
Yes. And so they told me that there was a city ordinance that said your music cannot be heard 50 feet from the source of the music, or it has to be turned down.
50 feet. I'm trying to picture 50 feet. So like a couple of storefronts.
So I walked 50 paces away and listened.
Which had to be scary leaving your equipment.
Yes, I walked backwards because I wanted to keep my eyes actually on the equipment.
And
then
there
was someone that I trusted there that day. So they were looking at my hand signals, telling them to turn it down a little bit more or turn it up a little bit more, like a thumbs up, thumbs down kind of sign. And so we got it adjusted. And then, you know, I proceeded to still sing. I felt like, you know, it was still loud enough. And so that was fine. And then another time the security came by and said, you can't use this outlet that's on this light pole that was right across from me, probably about maybe 8 feet away. And so I said, okay, which I saw other people using it to charge their cell phones and different things. So
what did you make of that? When you'd seen other people using it?
I felt that it was a deliberate attack to try to get me to leave or feel offended. And so I didn't let that deter me. I politely said okay and disconnected it. And then I bought a generator at Home Depot that I could charge overnight and take it with me and plug everything into that.
So that brings up the question, like, investing in this, is it lucrative?
I think it is. in more than just a monetary way. Internally, it's lucrative for me just to see the smiles on people's faces and to see the people in a starchy business suit just break out and start dancing on the sidewalk. You know, and
it's worth it.
Yeah, it's greatly worth it to see, you know, the elderly couples holding hands, walking by, and they start dancing to a slow song that I happen to be singing, you know, to just bring special moments out in an ordinary day to me is very lucrative.
Did you learn anything else about what is and isn't allowed from run-ins with security in various locations? Is it just in the Plaza location that you had these kinds of run-ins?
No, another park I went to sing in was the park in downtown Kansas City across from the Marriott Hotel. And it's supposed to be a public park. And we were singing
there. Is
that
Barney Alice Plaza, I think?
I'm not sure. It has some fountains in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see like a sign posted to say what the name of the park was, but I know that it was across from the Marriott Hotel, and there was a lot of traffic and foot traffic there. And so I thought it would be a great place to sing at. And singing was allowed there, but what wasn't allowed, we found out from the security guards, was it was not allowed for us to accept tips. And then that...
And that's because of this whole panhandling distinction.
I think so. I think that anytime they look at the cameras, they're sitting in their office, and they see someone handing someone money, they're automatically assuming that I asked for that money or I'm begging for that money. But in my case, I never ask anybody for money. I never beg anybody for money. They voluntarily brought their money over to me because they liked my music, they liked my voice, and they wanted to support me to keep singing. And
so is the not asking the distinction there for you?
I think it is. I think that panhandling and begging for money is one thing, but what I'm doing is providing a service. I'm providing a change in atmosphere, an improvement in mood, and some precious moments for people and their families.
Well, hang on with me a minute. Okay. I'm talking with Jazz, also known as Jazzy Jams. She's a one-woman band. Our next guest has done some research on all of this. Matthias Young is a music director for a church in Atlanta. He has a blog, and for the blog, he did a post on busking laws for street performers. It was a really in-depth piece with information on how laws differ from one part of the country to another. Matthias, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you hear in Jazz's story? Is this the kind of story you've heard a lot?
Oh, absolutely. And I think she certainly went about it in the correct way, seeing if there was any sort of permit that she needed to get to perform. And what that really brings to mind is simply the gray areas between cities that have regulations for busking, some of which are very loose, some are very strict. But then you also have discrepancies, let's just say, from use of public spaces and those discrepancies in the laws, even when there may or may not be regulations on busking, can make it very difficult, especially if you're having to deal with security or law enforcement.
You know, in a city like Kansas City, there is something that's been happening here for a while, which is privatization of public streets. So the neighborhood that Jazz is describing, the Plaza, they're actually privately owned streets running through this neighborhood, a shopping district. And that's happening in other neighborhoods in Kansas City, too. So that's also a tricky thing. Is it the law that you're trying to find out or the rules of a particular district?
And that's another tricky spot, because as you go from one area of the city to another, you can have all sorts of different regulations. Just here in Atlanta, it's made up of lots and lots of different smaller neighborhoods, and each one of those has different regulations for street performing. So you really have to be aware of the law to avoid any possible run-ins. And again, even with that, if there's discrepancies and such, or if maybe the police, they think they're following the correct law, but perhaps they're not, that's where some issues can arise.
You are not a lawyer and you are not a busker. Explain how you came to be so knowledgeable about this.
So I did a lot of research on this. I've got a lot of friends and colleagues that do this, and I realized that there really wasn't online a good central hub where if someone wanted to find out information about this, that they could just go to one place and get that information. So I ended up writing this article and included a lot of cities as well as links to their codes and such. And hopefully it's been very, very beneficial for people. But just mainly I wanted to inform people so that when they're either performing or traveling to other cities, they'll be able to provide a fantastic experience and hopefully avoid any legal issues.
You know, as we looked around for resources on busking law, it seemed like your blog post was pretty much the only thing out there that communicated this stuff in plain language, which to me is, in other words, for the performers and not for people maybe hoping to bust them.
So definitely for the performers, and a lot of my colleagues will travel around from city to city, and it's so important to know: do you need a permit? Do you not need a permit? Where can you set up things like that? Because it's going to be so different from one city to the next.
You know, I'm curious about some of the peculiarities, or maybe particularities of various busking laws around the country that you found especially interesting, and some of the major distinctions from one city to the next that would determine for a performer, is this going to be, this city going to be friendly to me or not?
Well, on one hand, when you do have cities that require permits and have pretty strict regulations, hopefully you will have a city that's going to be very welcoming to street performers, assuming that you're following those regulations. For instance, San Francisco are actually licensed and follow a schedule in certain areas, which is very interesting. So you know, really, just wherever you're going to set up, knowing those exact rules can make it such a wonderful experience.
What do you think it's important for non-performers to get about busking law, so people who might live in a neighborhood where busking happens, you know, maybe they find it disruptive, or conversely, people who really enjoy this aspect of street life and want to be allies for performers who make it possible?
So that's where it gets very interesting, because when we're listening to music, it, of course, is going to be very subjective. Is it good? Is it not good? What do we like about it? What's going to be intrusive, perhaps, in a business district in terms of a sound violation? One of the issues is, of course, setting up in a right-of-way. Are pedestrians, is their path being obstructed? Does it become an issue of loitering or panhandling? And those are things that we have to keep in mind so that we can try and clearly discern, okay, is this a street performance, or is this something else like panhandling and whatnot? Because nobody wants to, of course, have an issue with running into the law. And of course, if people watching understand what the law is as well, they'll hopefully be less likely to get police involved.
Jazz, you know, at the end of the day, if you have your choice of performing on the street or performing somewhere else, what do you choose?
Well, I think I would choose indoor, only because the temperature is regulated, the weather is
dry.
Yes, and And it just looks more classier, actually. And, you know, you can decorate and, you know, just make things more comfortable for everyone. But as an alternative, when I didn't have that option, I felt going to the street was fine as well.
Yeah. Well, Jazz of Jazzy Jams, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Matthias Young, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
There's a session on, there's a Lawrence Busker Festival this weekend. It's an annual festival. This year's festival is the first one that's specifically for women who busk. So why is that? Stay tuned to find out. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today's conversations about busking are inspired by the Lawrence Buskers Festival that's going to be going on this weekend. This year's festival is an all-women's festival, the first in the world, actually. And so now we're going to talk about that. Are there things that women in busking need to think about that are gender-specific? I want to start with Lindsay Lindbergh, also known as Mama Lou. She was apparently really vocal about wanting this to be a women's busking festival.
Well, Richard had the idea originally.
Richard Renner, the organizer.
The organizer, who's been a part of creating this magical festival for the last 11 years now in Lawrence. He asked me, do you think it is something that should happen? And I just jumped in and said, hell yeah, let's do it. You know, I've been a busker for about 12, 13 years now, and I've really seen a big change and shift in the tide between when I first started. There were all of these festivals and they had one slot that they would give to a girl show. And it didn't matter if...
Was that what it gets called?
Yeah. Well, they were called chick shows.
Oh.
Yeah. And so it didn't matter if they had three male jugglers or three guys who do magic shows.
Those were just shows.
Yeah. But they would have multiple shows where the men would have quite similar stunts. It wasn't about stunts. It was just that they had one slot for chick shows. And so even if you had a different... I'm a strong woman and then there would be another...
What does that mean?
What does a strong woman
mean?
Oh, my show is that I do old-fashioned feats of strength, and they're all real, and it's kind of this embodiment of an empowering woman who doesn't have to look like she's super dangerous, but that I actually do all of these things, like roll up frying pans and rip decks of playing cards and
challenge
people.
Do you kick through brick walls?
If I need to, yes.
Because I want to learn how to do that. Just for personal use.
Absolutely.
Well, so then an all-women's busking festival would just be that opportunity for visibility. And would you even use the word legitimacy?
I would use the word legitimacy because I think that there is a perception that chick shows don't have the same draw or the same power that a male show would. And so I think having an entire lineup of all female performers who are the best of the best throughout the world just gives legitimacy to the fact that it will be a fantastic festival, and you don't have to relegate it to some kind of quota where there's one or two involved and now, oh, great, I did my part. Look, here's my quota of girls. I'm being fair. This idea that women can carry an entire festival and it will be amazing, I think that's a really exciting thing. It's a watershed moment.
Well, my next guest is Martika Daniels. She is one of the women participating in the festival as well. Martika, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. What is your act? Can you describe it?
Yes. I'm a one-woman stunt show. So specifically, I work with sideshow stunts and combining circus acts as well. So
I need you to describe these in more detail because I've heard a little bit about them and you aren't doing them justice right now. They're totally crazy and amazing.
Yes, for me, it's an everyday job. So I do tend to forget how crazy they are to other people. But one stunt that I really loved doing and innovated is called a barbed wire hula hoop. So it's a hoop that's made out of only barbed wire. It's unaltered, and there's nothing to protect me. There will be nothing on my stomach or my back. There's absolutely nothing that you can do to protect yourself from sideshow stunts. But I hula hoop with barbed wire, and I aim for a balloon target. And I use a very nice willing volunteer to hold the balloon target in their hand as I aim for it.
How did you innovate this?
So I do a lot of hula hooping, just basic hula hooping. There's going to be a wonderful hula hoop act at the Lawrence Busker Festival, so you can see what a traditional style hula hooping performer is. But I took the normal hula hoop and I thought, how can I make this more exciting and more dangerous and really combined the sideshow style of using a sharp object or unconventional object. And I decided, well, I could add the barbed wire to the hoop, which I do have an LED barbed wire hula hoop that lights up. And it's just a hoop surrounded with barbed wire, but I wanted to completely take it away and just make it something that looked very medieval. So it's just barbed wire.
How did you get into this stuff? There's more like sword swallowing, right?
Yeah, there's all sorts of fire. Stuff. Yes, fire eating, fire breathing, sword swallowing. Sometimes I do escape stunts with chains and ropes.
But you were going to be a veterinarian.
Oh, yeah, that's that is almost a lifetime ago. I have a degree as a veterinary technician, and I did work in a corporate lab for a little while.
But now you eat fire and hula hoop barbed wire. And, I totally appreciate that. I am interested in whether being a woman, and in fact, not just a woman of color, if that affects what it's like for you to perform on the street.
It does. I get a lot of people, again, you guys were mentioning panhandling. I have had all sorts of comments directed at me while I'm busking on the street. Like, don't look at her. She's just asking for money. You know, people instantly look at me and they just use the stereotypical views of Black women who are on the street for a variety of reasons. And I have had to battle that and basically find a spot for myself on the pitch and for my voice to be heard. And like, no, I'm here performing this art form. And also with a lot of the stunts that I do, they look scary to people. So just a woman on the street holding a sword, of course, people are not going to instantly want to stop and see what you're doing.
And so how have you dealt with that?
I feel like my personality is very warm and inviting. And I like to, when I busk, I just remind myself I'm having conversations with these people, whoever that may be. And a lot of them haven't had a lot of positive human interactions with someone that looks like me. I work a lot in rural Kansas. I do county fairs as well. So I may end up being the one Black woman in that place. So I have to stand as an advocate, not just as a busker, but as a Black female saying, I'm here, we're going to have fun together, and we're going to learn something about each other in the process.
That is quite a weight to carry, though, to
sometimes
think that the way you conduct yourself in this conversation is going to be that person's entire first-hand experience of your race.
Yeah, sometimes I've had some interesting conversations, I will say. I don't have to repeat them, but some interesting conversations. And it's coming from a place of, I don't know who you are, I don't know anything about you, and I'm curious, but I don't know the best way to articulate that. So sometimes it comes off as almost passive aggressive or sometimes racist, but they don't realize they're doing that. So we have that conversational moment of maybe that comment's not inappropriate, or maybe this is how we should talk to each other. Basically,
what do you think about an all women's busking festival? Do you we've talked a lot about the race piece of it. I'm not sure where the gender piece totally fits in for you, whether there are issues of safety, whether there are issues of perception.
Well, what Lindsay was talking about, where people try to fill that quota, well, it's definitely the same for me. And one's like, okay, we have all the women that we need. Okay, now we also want to have people of color. Oh, we already have the women and we have our one Black guy or whoever. Well, we've got our two quotas, so we don't need this one show. Even though I may fit those puzzles, it's still hard for me to fit in two shows, especially being what we call a ground act. I'm not really high in the air. I'm more low towards the ground. I do dangerous stunts as well. So for me, being a niche within a niche, it's kind of hard for people to like, where should we put her?
And I don't know if I'm putting words in your mouth if I say this, but it sounds a little bit like you aren't even being evaluated based on the act you do.
Sometimes I am and sometimes I'm not. It kind of depends. I've worked with some busking festivals that have been amazing at saying that we want to just have more women and they don't try to pigeonhole me so much into the act that I do, which is, it feels great. People take you seriously and me not having to fight as much for my space in the show, basically, or the festival.
When we hear about a strong woman act, which is what Lindsay does, mm-hmm. when you think about your act and the danger in it, is there something about doing an act with barbed wire, with fire, mm-hmm. with swords, as a woman specifically, that feels important to you?
Oh, definitely. People don't like to see women hurt or put in positions that they could be hurt. So, performing this and showing young women that, yes, I'm put in this position that I may seem like I'm in danger or I am in danger with the things that I do, that I don't need someone to come help me or come protect me. I'm choosing this, and that I'm not only choosing this, but I'm also choosing where I want the show to go. You know, the flow, the feeling of it. I'll talk a lot about uplifting aspects of the show. And I talk about how even though the world is terrifying and tries to cut us up inside, that we too can be indestructible. And I physically show that.
Do you have people trying to come in and help you, save you?
When I do more busking festivals than I do just busk anymore. And when I was just busking, I've had some people try to ask me if I need help or if someone was making me do this. I'm trying to remember some of the comments that I've had over the years. Some I try to forget.
Well, so when you think about this upcoming festival, it brings mm-hmm. people in from all over the country, as we've said. Is there anyone you're especially excited to see, especially excited to meet?
Lindsay. I mean, I saw her busking growing up in my career as a busker. You know, sitting here at a table with her is a really big deal. I'm excited for that in and of itself. And there's so many amazing acts that are coming in. Oh, my gosh. The Farmer Daughters show. I met Molly in Newfoundland, and I'm excited to see her again and be able to run into old friends. So there's so many names that I can think of off Kate the Great, Sarah. I haven't been able to meet her from Hawaii, but I've heard about her a lot.
I want to jump in and say, Lindsay, so this is what you've said about this being a first, this all women's busking festival. Do you think that that has affected just the draw of this festival in Kansas, that there are women who are like finally and willing to come from anywhere for it?
Yes. What is really actually going back to what Martika was just saying about being excited to perform alongside women that she's grown up watching, having mentors and roles for young women is such an important thing, because it's this idea of what you see before you, now you know it's possible and you can go and achieve that. And one of the coolest things is, we were out last night with a bunch of the ladies who've flown in from all over the world. I was meeting a ton of women who are really working the scene a lot. They're really traveling the world, you know, on their own merits. And I can see how much the world is changing. And what was really great is I got to sit down. I'm sharing a room with Sharon Mahoney.
Who is that?
Sharon Mahoney has... She is one of the
You're
women
like touching
who I've
your
always
heart right now.
Yes. I looked up to her. She was the Mama Lou for me when I was starting. You know, she mm-hmm. had a rockin' awesome solo female show. Back when I started, there were only about four in the world who I could look up to. And so what's really great is now getting to meet these younger women and to see everything shifting, and to get to mentor and get to talk to them and bring them into the world and say, hey, girl, mm-hmm. like, nobody gave this to you. You earned it. And you earned a seat at the table. And congrats, you're here with us. So.
What's your response to that, Martika?
It's very powerful. I don't know. It's hard to put words to it, because I'm so used to being surrounded by men that it's just a different feeling, you know, a different form of understanding that my peers that are men on the street, it's not quite the same connection. It's hard to put words to it.
When we were out at dinner last night, it was so charming, because we realized that the feeling around the table was so different than when you have a mix of guys and girls. And it actually was so maternal. It was so interesting that we all were there and just going, how have you been? And we're very supportive of each other and the women, because we are this minority. And when we actually do get together, it's like a sisterhood. And Richard was saying, like, at the table, that just how much motherly love was around.
You have a frying pan, and I'm kind of afraid to ask. What are you going to do with this frying pan? Should I be ducking?
Yeah. You know, actually, speaking of kind of this female thing, I like to make fun of this idea that the woman's role is in the kitchen. And so I have a part of my show where I bring people over to cook them breakfast, and I end up destroying everything, though, in my path. And so one of the things I brought with me was one of my frying pans.
I'd love to see this.
Yeah.
How are you going to destroy this frying pan?
I definitely am. All right. So as we know, the best way to get lots of protein in your diet is some delicious eggs in the morning. But
she
it turns out
bending this with her hands.
It turns
folding
out.
It. Oh my God.
Sometimes the cooking side of eggs is a little harder than you'd think. And so as a strong woman, I've found that I have more than one ways to crack that egg.
This.
Lindsay Lindberg, Mama Lou.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That's beautiful. Yes. A totally wrapped up and folded omelet-esque frying pan. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Martika Daniels, thank you.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Both women will be performing at the first all-women's busking festival this weekend in Lawrence, Friday through Sunday. There's a schedule at lawrencebuskerfest.com. Up next, the story behind that controversial mural coming to downtown Overland Park. The muralist will tell us what it's really about for him. Stay tuned. A design for a new mural coming to downtown Overland Park has gotten a lot of attention thanks to a handful of vocal objectors. They've expressed concern over the mural's depiction of Muslim women in headscarves and Native Americans. And after some debate, the mural was officially approved. The project is moving forward as planned. In all the hubbub, what we haven't really heard is the story of the mural itself from the artist. What's this project about? What's he trying to do? What's the plan? I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to step back from the controversy and tell that story. JT Daniels, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's been a month, huh?
Yeah, you can say that.
So to start, I want to be sure people know who you are, because there's a good chance our listeners do recognize your work, even if they don't know your name. You did the wall outside of Betty Ray's in the City Market, and then that mural inside Ruby Jean's Juicery, the one that says health is freedom.
So I did the mural on the outside of Ruby Jean's.
Oh, okay. And can you tell me, so tell us about some of your other work. What have you done?
See, a few of the other projects that I have in the city, at least, there's the wall located on the side of the Gym Theater over off 18th and Vine. It's got a reference to Charlie Parker. I've got some projects that I've done with the Casey Streetcar. I've got a mural or two in Lee Summit. I've got one that I'm going to start in Raymore this summer. And I've got another one off of Truce, just like 31st and Linwood.
Bright colors and, like, people generally having a good time.
So a lot of my murals, my community-based murals are usually based on community, so, like, diversity, inclusion, and representation, and then just how all of that with just a good vibe, energy, lots of bright colors, like, representing, like, what they wear and what they wouldn't wear, all meshed together in a really fun way that's good for kids and adults.
How did this downtown Overland Park project come about?
Nicole Emanuel, who she works with the Inner Urban Art House, or she was one of the founders of it, approached me with the project. I want to say the end of 2018, we did a community project where we designed a yurt with three other artists. And it was an ongoing project called Tangled Roots.
You designed a yurt?
The yurt was already prefabricated. We just painted the exterior and the interior of a yurt as a community project.
And so the downtown Overland Park mural, was this idea brought to you as like, hey, here's this location. What would you propose here?
I think she's been kind of throwing the idea around for a few years now. Like, I know she's been setting it up for at least 3 to 4 years. She had talked about it. She mentioned it a few times. There's a couple other artists that are lined up to paint. And
because it's a few different walls all around.
I want to say there's at least 4 or 5 different walls. And so there's myself. There's Scribe. You know, he's a local artist. There's Visual Goodies or Aaron Sutton, Isaac Enrico. They kind of go by a group. And then there's also Emily Alvarez that'll be painting as well.
So the particular wall that you are painting is by 10,000 Villages.
It's on the rear side of 10,000 Villages in the alleyway.
And so when you thought about that location, what were the ideas going through your mind?
Well, originally she showed us the sites. The two sites were already picked out and those were going to Scribe. She had one that was pre-set up and I saw it and I was like, I was interested in it, but I had an idea already in mind. And, as soon as
what was the idea you already had in mind?
Well, it just had the name 10,000 Villages. And, I told myself like my goal for the year was to expand outward and I try to do at least a minimum of 2 to 3, community-based projects, whether they are, charity work or for pay or kind of whatever we work out. And last year I did a few community projects and I really liked the feeling of that. And then I heard the title 10,000 Villages. At the time I was working in Overland Park already, a couple streets over off of 87th and Metcalf. And like the name 10,000 Villages, I was like, man, there's so much you can do with that. It really fits in with kind of my current art style that I did. And then after really sitting down and thinking about it, I was like, well, I really want to add a lot of color into it. I want to add a lot of texture and design. But since the organization itself, so 10,000 Villages is a not-for-profit and is run mostly by women. And what they do is they do fair trade. They buy products and items from other people in other countries, like 45 other countries. And I found out through talking to the lady, of the 45 countries, there were about 4 or 5 countries specifically that they bought from really heavily. So I decided, it's like, well, let me pinpoint these makers in these countries. And then I really wanted to project like how like just these women were really proud about the things they made and they're making income for their families. And they happen to be countries where it was primarily women making the items, even though like there are family matters, so on and so forth. And so it was a reflection of the strong women running that company, but then the strong women in these countries that they purchased from, but then also how that was a direct correlation within the women that are already living in Overland Park and in that city. Shopping there, going to the farmer's market, and just how, like, even though the community there may be becoming more diverse and it's not shifting, but it's growing, just showing how much of an impact that has the people living there in connection with everywhere else.
So can you describe what the design, what the plan for this mural looks like and what it is people have had the chance to see that people have responded in all kinds of different ways to?
I mean, it's one of the first murals that I've painted where I didn't change the skin colors up. So normally I remove skin color and I put in like greens, blues, orange, yellow.
Yeah, that's whatever. True.
And I felt that would do, as a representation of the organization, like kind of a disservice by like removing that.
Yeah, because the people are usually like rainbow colors.
They're all rainbow colors. And that's one of the things, like I show ethnicity, but I don't play really heavily on the skin color, and that really makes everyone feel like they are a part of the mural and then they can see themselves reflected in that. And in this mural, I wanted people to see themselves reflected in that, but still to specifically honor these specific people. Like, hey, these are the people that you're actually buying from, but then they also do represent the people that live here as well. And I think one thing I've heard anyway is like in Overland Park, what I've seen is a lot of people really want to express a certain narrative, or they like to they want something that represents their history. And I really didn't want to cherry pick the good portion of the history or remove like something that may not be, you know, so good for everybody. But I wanted to reflect like what's it look like now.
Can you explain that?
Yes and no. maybe not on the air. I don't know. I don't want to cause like an uproar or make people upset. But a lot of people are talking about, like, we want our history, to be reflected in this way. And sometimes a positive point in history isn't always positive from every aspect or for every person.
So when someone's saying our history, they might specifically mean their very own personal history.
Their very own personal history. And really what I wanted to reflect on is, like, as a community, there's different forms of history that are going into that. And because they were asking for diversity and inclusion, and when I got the mural project proposed to me, it was kind of on the table. I can do what I like to do. And really, I talked to 10,000 villages, and I asked them what they were looking for and just what they did and what they represented. Instead of painting just some random design or just a bunch of, like, abstract designs, I said, why don't I just focus on these people that you guys actually work with? And then I thought the community would respond to that. The community's growing. After working in the area for about 2 years, it started changing my mind about, like, because I don't personally live in Overland Park, but I've worked there and I've done other things there. It really started to expand and show, like, how the community is expanding, how it's growing.
Wait, did you have a perception of Overland Park before spending those 2 years?
And I did. I grew up thinking, like, you don't go to Overland Park because you're not going to be accepted there.
Who's or, you?
Like, me personally. I'm biracial, but, like black people or, like, my grandparents talking about redlining and stuff like that. And that's not a history that I really wanted to reflect on, because I worked at the Arts and Heritage Center that they built over in Overland Park, and they have a museum in there, and they talk about the specific points of, like, their history and how there's a lot of things that are good, but not everything is like that. And it's like that everywhere. And I just really felt like, in order to reflect what I thought was positive, I didn't really want to get into the historical aspect of that. I wanted to reflect on what's positively taking place today.
Because it sounds like actually spending time in Overland Park changed your ideas about it.
It did. So I was working as a art specialist or art consultant with adults with disabilities. And so I was teaching art, and I was going there day-to-day basis. And I was expecting to, you know, be treated a certain way, to get pulled over every day on my way to work. And sometimes it did happen, but not nearly as much as I expected it to. And I really had to check myself. And in checking myself and having continued conversations with coworkers and having different points of view, it really changed my perception of how I grew up hearing this from, like, my grandparents or other people around me, and just living and experiencing that there. And I really wanted to express how, like, there's a different narrative and how other people are included in that.
It sounds like you were hoping to create this image of what Overland Park looks like to you today, that to you is welcoming and inviting.
It's welcoming, it's inviting. I mean, you can see how your tax dollars are spent pretty clearly out there. Like, everything's nice, trimmed, and manicured. I mean, there's things to do. But, I mean, I like going out there to a certain extent. But also, it's just seeing how many other people there are. And I think people were getting upset because they felt like everyone wasn't reflected. And I felt like I wasn't trying to reflect everyone in one piece of artwork. The other pieces of artwork, like Scribe is painting some birds that represent, like, one of the birds, one of the fish that represent things that are native to Kansas or Kansas City. The other artists are painting farmers, like Latin American farmers. There's, like, African spiritualism is tied into it. There's like Native American, like the Kanza, like the Native Americans that were part of Kansas beforehand. Those things were reflected in the other murals. And I felt in my specific mural, I just wanted to reflect just this subset of people kind of saying, hey, I see you and we recognize you. And I'm pinpointing you specifically, but you're not forgotten or you're not overlooked. And I felt like I didn't have to include everyone that was a subsect out there, because there's other walls that you can do that, or because I felt those people are already highly reflected in everything else that goes on. So you don't need me to specifically paint you into that mural when you're predominantly there already.
Has the response to your design surprised you?
Yes and no. Not yes, because I didn't expect it to be as much as it was. And no, because it's new to their area as far as having public art and public murals. And so I understand how murals and public artwork can change the vibe in an area. And I'm really understanding of that. And I've just been really patient with it.
Well, JT Daniels, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
JT's mural will be going up in downtown Overland Park in the near future. We will follow the story. And that's a wrap. You can revisit either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. That's where you can find any of our past shows. I highly recommend yesterday's, our search for useful advice for high school grads, with input from people young enough to know how that advice is going to land. kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow is a food show. We're talking about sushi, tartare, oysters, you know, all the stuff we eat raw that used to make people kind of nervous, but now we all love it. That's the stuff we're talking about tomorrow at 10. Today's show was produced by Coy Duggar, and we have a whole team of producers, but today is Coy's last show before he goes, so this is a special thanks to a dedicated, hardworking, talented young producer and announcer who we hope to hear more from. There are no words other than thank you, so thank you. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.